This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members of FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
When the team at the Canadian Museum for Human Rights decided to measure its impact, the journey they ended up taking went much, much deeper. From building a theory of change to undergoing a strategic planning process, the road traveled was comprehensive and challenging. But as CEO Aisha Khan says, it was well worth it. We find out why when we speak with her next. Welcome to In the Business of Change, where we speak with social entrepreneurs and change makers impacting their communities and the world. I'm your host, Elisa Birnbaum, publisher and editor-in-chief of Sea Change magazine. On today's episode, the last of three sponsored by impact consultancy Junction Strategy, I'm joined again by the always affable and oh-so-eloquent co-host, President and CEO of Junction, Mike Rollins. We'll be speaking with Aisha Khan, CEO of the Canadian Museum for Human Rights, and Charla Vall, Consulting Director at Junction, about the extensive work they recently completed together. Some questions we'll explore include, what is a theory of change, and why was that the starting point? How did the strategic planning process then unfold? What frustrations did they encounter along the way? And what takeaways could every business, big or small, learn from on their own purposeful journey? Stay tuned to find out. I'm delighted to be joined once again by my co-host, Mike Rollins, for our third podcast conversation of our series, which has been so exciting and so much fun. And I'm so glad that we're making this work. Mike, why don't you start off the conversation? Tell us, who are we chatting with today? What is the general theme that we're exploring?
Fabulous. I will. I'm excited for this conversation. We've had the distinct pleasure to work with Aisha Khan, the CEO of the Canadian Museum for Human Rights, over the course of the last couple of years. And so Aisha's joining us today, and my colleague Charla Vall is the consulting director at Junction. And we're going to talk a little bit about the museum and about its position in the work toward human rights for all. And we'll talk a little bit about the theory of change work that Junction supported them with last year, and the strategic plan that they'll be unveiling in the coming weeks. But we'll also learn a little bit about the museum and its work and its history and its place in the Canadian context. So as I say, really looking forward to the conversation. I'm Aisha. Welcome, Charla. Good to see you again, Elisa.
Thank you so, so much. Aisha, why don't we start off with you? Do you want to introduce yourself and how you came to the museum?
Sure. My name is Aisha Khan, and I'm the CEO here at the museum. Been the CEO since August of 2020, so nearing 4 years now. I think I describe myself on social media as a humanity lover. What that means is I've been passionate about human rights for most of my career. I'm a lawyer by training. I've held other leadership positions. And I was just really excited to join the museum and the potential that it holds for engaging so many people, Canadians and around the world, in dialogue and learning about human rights.
Thank you for that. Charla, what Wonderful. About you? Do you want to do another intro? We've introduced you on earlier episodes, but we'd love to hear from you again.
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to. So I'm Charla Vall, and I'm consulting director with Junction Strategy. And I sponsor and lead projects at Junction, ranging from articulating purpose to defining strategy and measuring impact with so many of Junction's incredible clients.
Perfect.
Yeah. So the Canadian Museum for Human Rights, a federal crown corporation, And one of just a few of Canada's national museums that sits outside the national capital area of Ottawa. I was fascinated from my first introduction with the mandate that the museum has. So the museum's mandate is to explore the subject of human rights with special but not exclusive reference to Canada in order to enhance the public's understanding of human rights, to promote respect for others, and to encourage reflection and dialogue. A big, big mandate. Big scope of work, very lofty, very ambitious, very large scale, but also beautiful in its way, right? To promote understanding, to promote respect, and to encourage reflection and dialogue on human rights. And alongside that, as with all of Canada's national museums, the Canadian Museum for Human Rights plays a really important role in preserving and promoting our heritage at home and abroad. It contributes to the collective memory and sense of identity of all Canadians. It is most definitely, I can say, having visited it, a source of inspiration, but also of research and learning and entertainment that belongs to all Canadians. It is a national museum. It is an asset of Canadians. And it provides in both of our official languages a service that is essential to Canadian culture and available to everybody. So a remarkable institution, but boy, that mandate is lofty, Aisha, to explore the subject of human rights with special but not exclusive reference to Canada. Can you start by giving us a bit of an intro to the museum and how it came to be and a sense of its work and its reach?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say, the mandate rolled off your tongue very smoothly. So I gotta get better at that. The museum is, as you've noted, just a very special place. And by design, we're a pretty young institution. We opened our doors almost a decade ago, so in September of 2014. But the project started to create this kind of museum in the early 2000s. And Israel Asper, you know, well-known Canadian philanthropist, media mogul, and then his family had the idea that we would have a place in Canada centered in Winnipeg, in the center of Canada, where students and people from all over could come and learn and reflect on human rights. And so the project started with that one idea. It became a huge, large-scale capital campaign in the arts and culture sector, brought in private and public sector supporters. And then in 2008, was established as the National Museum of Canada. And at the time, the first, as you said, outside of the National Capital Region. So a big feat. The story, I suppose, that's also important is that it is one of these iconic buildings in Canada. And they had launched an international architectural competition. The architect, Antoine Prédoc, actually just passed away last week. It was well known, and this project was so important to him in weaving the concept of human rights into the building itself. And interestingly, one part of it is, as a national museum, was that it would be launched and established with this idea that it would be a different kind of museum, you know, leveraging digital technology to reach all Canadians coast to coast to coast. Yeah, it's a special place. I know we'll talk more about it and the work that we've done, but I will say that its mandate is big, but I don't know that it's lofty in that it's aspirational. I actually see it the opposite. I see it as this simple, pure, fundamental kind of mandate that should be easy to achieve. We get in the way, don't we?
So grateful for that reframe, because you're absolutely right. We can do that work every day just by virtue of the programs that the museum offers. Right? Yeah. I appreciate that reframe.
Charlotte, let me ask you a question. You were working on this project right from the very start, and you started with developing a theory of change. I'm wondering why you started with a theory of change and how that went about.
Sure. The museum had asked Junction to help them measure their impact. And we believe that a theory of change is a really important starting point because it articulates the changes that you want to make in the world. And without knowing what changes you desire, how do you know what to measure? So this is a framework that the nonprofit sector has actually been using for decades. And we think that it's transferable to companies that want to create positive change too. And a theory of change, it simply looks to illustrate how do we get from here to there. So at the top of your theory of change is your impact statement, the ultimate impact that you wish to create. So for a social enterprise or a purpose-driven company, this statement would essentially be your purpose statement. And then at the bottom of it is the activities that you're primarily going to put into play in order to achieve your purpose or your desired impact. And above those activities sits the first layer of changes that you expect will result from your action. So these are your short term. And above that sits your intermediate outcomes or your medium term outcomes, which may stem from one or more of your short term outcomes. And then above the intermediate sits your long term outcomes, which again, they might stem from one or more of your intermediate outcomes. So once you have mapped that out, measuring your progress becomes a whole lot more straightforward because you can simply determine what metrics you'll use to measure whether each of those changes occurred along the way and how much change occurred.
Okay, great. Thank you. Sounds like a good reason to you started at the theory of change, as complex as that might sound. There's a lot of work that goes into it, basically, is what I'm saying. There's a lot of work. Mike, did you have a question?
I'm really keen to learn about the next step in the strategic planning work, but I'd love to ask Aisha here how the theory of change has landed with the team. It's sort of, how's its utility been? How has the conversation been about that tool and the framework and the variety of conversations we had in developing it?
So I have the benefit of looking back on the work. And so when I answer it today, how has it landed? It's fantastic. It has changed the way that we think about who we are, the work that we do, what our outcomes are. It's given them definition and therefore helped, is starting to help us make decisions. So, but it's still kind of early days. If I look back to first engaging in the work, I didn't know what to make of the theory of change. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't know why we needed one. Why is it just a theory? It was abstract and hard to figure out how it would help me in the decisions that I want to make or that our team wants to make every day. I see it now, though. What I do know is that you have to learn to trust the process, and there's a lot of thinking that goes underneath it.
I'm grateful to hear that in retrospect, it's felt like a really valuable process. I know that because I was with you through the process of development, that it's hard. It's not easy. It's not simple. It's very conceptual. And so it is important for everybody to sort of trust the process and allow it to unfold. But in our work, that process continued into a strategic planning engagement, a whole new set of conversations, a whole new set of ambiguity. Where are we going? Where do we want to be? How fast do we want to get there? How did that strategic planning process unfold? I'm kind of keen to hear from both Aisha and Sharla on this because you both looked at it from different views.
Yeah, let's see where we land. I can tell you from our perspective, it was much like the development of the theory of change. During the process, it felt at times challenging. Conversations got crunchy. We had those moments of existential crisis, but looking back, all for good, because looking back, I think the process was designed to create the outcomes that we wanted. And one of the outcomes was to engage in a different kind of process, to use a more decolonized lens to planning, to be guided by a theory of change and impact-oriented discussions. So yeah, it ebbed and flowed the process, but the strategic planning process. But I think what we got at the end of it and how it aligns with the theory of change and gives us a path, we called our work our path forward, which aren't just words. It truly did get us there.
Charlotte, do you want to add something?
Sure. I mean, I think the strategic planning process was one of the most comprehensively designed processes that I've been a part of. We aimed to be as inclusive as possible and gather as much information from all parts of the organization as we can. With the Canadian Museum for Human Rights, we have this national mandate. We had to also try and gather input from Canadians from coast to coast to coast. And so it really was quite a beautiful discovery process in that we engaged at least 50% of the 200 staff at the museum. I don't know what the final numbers were for the public or discussions with communities that were held across the country, and interviews and surveys and just all kinds of different ways of gathering input, ideas,
One of the things I appreciated about the process was how inclusive it was, right? Aisha talks about a decolonized process and an inclusive process. And we really did go out of our way to include as many voices as possible in the plan. So the process was very inclusive and you might say exhaustive. It was ambitious. I'm curious for your views now as you look back on it, as on the product at the end of the process. When you think about the actual plan and the actual framework for the path forward, are there pieces of it that most excite you or that you feel most proud of or that seem to be inspiring the team more than others? What's your take on the plan itself at this point, Aisha?
One of the most beautiful parts about the process and therefore the framework or plan that came out of it is that it's not the traditional approach to, you know, these are our three pillars. It is interconnected parts, interconnected focus areas. And part of that is that idea of systems and Indigenous ways of thinking that inspire some of the way that we looked at this. But I think the part that excites me most about the plan is less what the plan tells us we're going to do, but how we got to it. Mm-hmm. And I think it was that understanding that as a museum that promotes human rights with the mandate that we have, there's no way that we can just sit, as you say, in a room and just decide this is how we're going to do human rights work. Our vision, our impact statement is to create a world where everyone values human rights and takes responsibility to promote respect and dignity for all. So how could we just do that alone? So it was inclusive, but it was less about us coming up with an idea and consulting with others on what they thought, which, you know, many people will do and often works. It was about actually incorporating the perspectives of others on our work. And so focusing on mandate more than centering ourselves, you know, we're the museum, mm-hmm. this is what we're gonna do, what do you think we should do? It was, how do you think we're going to actually move this impact? That's what excites me. And that's what makes it such a different kind of piece of work that we've all done together. It'll carry us forward. It's not like it's over in 5 years. It's a bit of it's a living document or a living plan. That's what really gets me going. That feels really good.
Yeah, I appreciate that too. In that way, the process is the product and the product is the process, right? It's about inclusion and respect all voices and including all voices. It's pretty remarkable.
Aisha, you kind of touched upon a little bit of some of the challenges. Wondering if the hardest part of the entire process, what would you say that was?
I think that when we committed to doing the process in a different way, to using the theory of change, to being outcome focused, and to having the process be more open and including as many voices as we could, the challenge was always to continue to check ourselves to make sure that we were actually doing that. Because time pressures, project schedules, there's times where we got to get something done. And there were times where we had to move and say, hold on a second, we have to go back to the elders who we began with. You know, we have to circle back to folks, or we have to bring in the team that we originally talked to about this and let them know what we learned from them before we just interpret what that was. So it was challenging to hold each other accountable, which, you know, gets in the way sometimes.
What about the benefits of the entire process?
I think we grew. I think we all learned something, and we learned something about doing the work in a different way, which I think we're still trying to process and figure out what that means. But I think that the success of the process was, I think it was almost, you know, we said almost 500 voices, 5 cities, you know, multiple ways, as Charlotte said, of getting input and ideas. So that's the part that I think people feel like they had some part in creating the impact that we are mandated to create. And I mean, honestly, the theory of change in that process it was designed to do that. And I feel like we did it. Mm-hmm. I think we did it again. Maybe we would do it slightly differently. We learned some things, but there was lots of growth, I think, individually and collectively through the process, which I'm still kind of reflecting on. There was a real turning point for us when we recognized that Junction working with us, the consultants working with us, weren't going to tell us what to do. They were going to help us understand what we were saying and doing. It was easy for us to think that we'd engage in this process and someone would sort of spit back to us what we wanted, what we should do. And at some point, I think we kind of realized, no, we've got to figure this out. They're going to help us. They're going to remind us, well, this is what you heard. This is what happened. They were going to help us with the methodology and how to do the work, but we still had to figure it out. That was a real turning point, I think, for us. We had to really get in deep and together.
I'm curious to hear Sharla's view. So from the consultant side of the table, looking at the project, what did you think were some of the hardest parts and what are the benefits that you're taking away?
Yeah, from a consulting perspective, certainly just have to mention the logistical challenges of trying to get input from such a broad group of people and so many different types of input that you're trying to synthesize and reflect back to the organization so that they can consider it as they decide on their priorities. But again, just coming back to the point that's been made about the processes, the product, you know, it was just so important to design it so that we were hearing from as many voices as possible. And then I think the challenge is how do you ensure that people feel their voices were heard while understanding that their voices may not be perfectly reflected in the plan? Because of course, we couldn't incorporate every idea or every challenge or every... you know, way of framing things. So it's a bit of a dance to ensure that people have this sense of ownership and buy-in into what's being developed without feeling like they've been dismissed or, you know, not heard.
Would this kind of approach that you developed in this scenario, would that be scalable to a smaller social enterprise?
Yeah, no, certainly. I think the process can be followed regardless of the size. It's just that if you're a smaller organization, you likely wouldn't need surveys. You likely wouldn't need consultations with hundreds of people. So you're really just, you know, you're trying to gather input from the people who are impacted by your organization and who you are going to impact. And that circle is just smaller, likely depending on the, you know, size of your organization.
Okay, good to know.
Actually, looking back on the process now, I think one of the things we're trying to do with this podcast is provide some insights to listeners who may be getting ready to navigate a similar process. So as a CEO who sort of led this process on behalf of a host of people at the museum, how would you advise other CEOs to think about navigating such a comprehensive strategic planning process? Are there principles that you would stick to or the things that you'd sort of hold top of mind as you embark on a process like this?
What was helpful for me in retrospect was leaving room for emergence. So having a plan, but leaving some either room by design for us to shift or pivot. Obviously, I think having enough relationship with the consultant, so with you, Mike, Sharla, the team, to have the relationship to be able to say, so this is where we're at, this is how we're feeling, we might need more time, or we need to do something else, people don't understand, or this is going to feel like it's not their plan, is important. But I think what underlies both of those things is knowing what you're trying to do, knowing why you're doing it. You know, for us, we wanted a plan, but it was less important to have a plan at the end of the day than it was to bring folks around together towards a common way of thinking about our work and some common purpose. And so I would say to others in my shoes, have a multidisciplinary team, keep your mind open to including folks in the process who you normally wouldn't, who are going to help keep you accountable to what the, you know, the principles are that you want to engage in the process. And then just being really honest through the process, which sometimes meant, yeah, we shifted timelines and it wasn't great for any of us. And I know there were apologies on both sides and things like that, because, you know, we're all busy people doing this work, but having enough relationship that we could explain why and that we were all invested in a process that would deliver the outcome that we wanted.
You touch on a couple of points that I think I feel most proud of about this project or this work together. You used the word crunchy before, and we used the word crunchy at a couple of points as we were going through the process. Like, we had a couple of crunchy weeks where it just didn't seem to be going right and people weren't quite clear on what we were trying to achieve. But it was the ability just fundamentally to be people in the room, call out what we were seeing that didn't seem right, adjust it, refine things, shift on the fly, apologize for the hiccups or mess ups. And it was like holding their relationship first, relationship first, relationship first, relationship first, in my view, the first three rules of business. And then navigating the process together is what led to the really great outcomes. I think it's hard to quantify how important that is. When you're engaging nearly 500 people over the course of better part of a year to complete the process, there are bound to be hiccups. There are bound to be shifts and changes along the way.
I agree with you. Although there were crunchy times, lessons learned are always from the difficult moments, for sure. But there was these incredible conversations about the world that we want to create for each other and how we'll be better humans to one another.
Thank you, everyone. Is there anything I did not give or we did not give you a chance to say?
I think that a lot of what has been said today really speaks or points to the care that goes into designing and carrying out the process of developing a theory of change and or a strategic plan. I think certainly a CEO could create either on the back of a napkin, but if you are really, really careful to design a process that engages the right people at the right time and throughout the process, you can really generate a significant degree of alignment and clarity around what you're trying to do. So I really think these are foundational tools that can set you up for long-term success.
Just really excited about the future of the Canadian Museum for Human Rights. I think this strategic planning work that we've done together has sort of repositioned us with some focus. And I always call us a young institution or organization. So maybe we're, you know, nearing our tweens or teens and we kind of know who we are. We're not exploring as far, but really recommitted through this process to delivering that mandate and that vision and just doing some really good work.
Thank you for joining this special episode of In the Business of Change, one of three sponsored by Junction and co-hosted by its president and CEO, Mike Rowlands.